From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. It is another busy day on Capitol Hill with confirmation hearings for President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet nominees.
So let's get right to that with the Senate Armed Services Committee hearing for retired Marine General James Mattis, Donald Trump's choice for Secretary of Defense. If confirmed, he could be the first career military officer to head the Pentagon since the 1950s. Mattis told the committee he doesn't believe the American military is robust enough right now to confront all the threats it faces. Here's an exchange with committee chair, the Republican John McCain.
I think deterrence is critical right now, sir. Absolutely. And that requires the strongest military.
Do you think we have a strong enough military today in order to achieve that goal?
No, sir.
Well, Phil Ewing is NPR's national security editor. He's been watching all of this. And Phil, did General Mattis have suggestions about how to beef up deterrence?
He did. He talked about a point that military leaders have made very often for the past several years, which is that restrictions Congress has put in place about spending in Washington constrain what the military is able to do in terms of buying equipment, but especially maintain what it calls readiness, the amount of bullets that soldiers can shoot on a range before they have to deploy, the number of miles you can drive in your tank before you actually have to go overseas, things like that. And what Mattis and other people in his world have complained about is that has fallen down since the peak of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And to be an effective deterrent force, as you heard him say in that clip, he views it necessary for it to get back there.
And how did, speaking of possible threats, how did Russia come up? Here's Mattis speaking a little on that topic.
I think right now the most important thing is that we recognize the reality of what we deal with Mr. Putin, and we recognize that he is trying to break the North Atlantic Alliance, and that we take the steps, the integrated steps, to defend ourselves where we must.
And Mattis is saying the U.S. Will need to work with NATO, not something Donald Trump said as a candidate. So talk about that gap being bridged.
That's a big gap, and that'll be one of the big themes to watch as Mattis and the other national security leaders in the Trump administration are confirmed and take their jobs. The positions they've outlined in their hearings this week and also in the comments before are separate from those that Trump had when he was a candidate before his election, and specifically NATO is one. The relationship between the U.S. and Russia is another. Mattis talked today about how NATO is so critical that if it didn't exist, we might have to invent it, and he made it sound as though, as Secretary of Defense, he will continue to support some of the movements that are already in process to send more military equipment to Europe, to send more American troops to Europe, and potentially even base them there permanently. He had an exchange with the committee chairman, Senator McCain, in which McCain said this isn't just an issue of sending them for 6 months or a few weeks at a time for exercises. Some Baltic states want American or NATO military bases there, full bases, and Mattis appeared to indicate that he could get behind something like that. The real question is, given the overtures that President-elect Trump has made to Russia and with Russia's President Vladimir Putin, will they conflict behind the scenes, or will Mattis and other advisors at his level be able to bring Trump around to their positions? And right now, I don't think anyone knows the answer to that question.
Well, I was wondering too, Phil Ewing, was this surprising to you or others that Mattis was contradicting Donald Trump?
It isn't a surprise because Mattis's record on a lot of these issues is very clear. And one reason he had such a warm reception in the Senate today and had such a mostly congenial session there in his confirmation hearing is because of how familiar he is to those lawmakers. He was a Marine Corps general and combatant commander for many years. He's well known to people in the national security world, people in Congress. And so the views that he holds about a lot of these issues are quite familiar. He told senators today that he didn't think Trump would have appointed him and he wouldn't have accepted the nomination if he didn't believe Trump would be receptive to what he called his input on these matters, on foreign policy, on national security, and the role of the intelligence agencies inside the government.
Well, he was also asked about fighting ISIS. Here he is responding to a question from the Iowa Republican, Joni Ernst.
We have to deliver a very hard blow against ISIS in the Middle East so that there's no sense of invulnerability or invincibility there. There's got to be a military defeat of them there. But it must, as you point out, be a much broader approach. This requires an integrated strategy.
Did he define that?
He didn't define it exactly except to say in a couple of other occasions that he wanted it to be more aggressive, to be more energized, and for the U.S. generally to do more than it's doing today in these twin wars against ISIS in Iraq and Syria. For critics like Trump and Republicans in Congress, they argue that President Obama, as he's waged this conflict, has done only the minimum possible in terms of supporting troops, supplying them with weapons, providing airstrikes, and giving logistical support to these forces on the ground. They want a much stronger U.S. effort to try and bring this campaign to a conclusion sooner. The Obama administration's argument has always been, we don't want American forces in danger. We don't want American troops fighting again for territory they already conquered in the most recent Iraq war, and that it makes the most sense to have these indigenous forces in both countries doing that.
We want to get one last exchange in. Here's Senator Kirsten Gillibrand pressing Mattis on issues like women in combat and members of the LGBT community in the military.
Senator, my belief is that we have to stay focused on a military that's so lethal that on the battlefield, it will be the enemy's longest day and their worst day when they run into that force.
Do you believe that allowing LGBT Americans to serve in the military or women in combat is undermining our lethality?
Frankly, Senator, I've never cared much about two consenting adults and who they go to bed with.
And I thought we'd just leave that without comment. That's retired Marine General James Mattis at his hearing today. We've been hearing about it from Phil Ewing, NPR's national security editor. Phil, thanks.
Thank you.
President-elect Donald Trump met today with executives from AT&T, apparently to discuss that company's proposed $85 billion merger with Time Warner. Meanwhile, another major U.S. company, Amazon, is saying today it'll add 100,000 jobs in the U.S. in the next year and a half, something Trump has been pressuring companies to do. Ali Velshi is an MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. He's in New York. Hi, Ali.
Hey, good to talk to you, Jeremy.
Good to talk to you, too. And before the election, Trump said his administration would not approve the merger of AT&T and Time Warner. Does he still feel that way, or would he be willing to stop this?
Well, he said so, but there's nothing in his policy positions that would indicate that he isn't going to do so. Generally speaking, a president works on mergers and acquisitions through their appointees to the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission. We only have one appointee to the Justice Department at the moment, and that is Jeff Sessions, who he's nominated as the secretary. So we don't know where he stands on it, but a lot of people say he's not really anti-mergers in general. He doesn't seem to like media companies. He got into a dust-up with CNN the other day. Obviously, that would be part of this, and there's some suggestion that AT&T may have to divest of CNN if it takes over Time Warner. But they don't seem that interested in CNN. The other parts of the business make more money.
Well, on the issue of mergers and acquisitions and antitrust issues, before the election, Trump was critical of Amazon, saying it had a huge antitrust problem. And today, we get this news from Amazon that they want to create 100,000 jobs in the U.S. in the next year and a half. Is Amazon doing this because of Trump?
Well, Donald Trump, through his spokesperson, Sean Spicer, did take credit for having a role in it. CEOs, I was just at the auto show earlier this week, Jeremy, and CEOs are learning that it takes very little to get Donald Trump to take credit for job creation. So if you announce jobs and Donald Trump takes the credit for whatever tangential role he may have played in it, you start to get on the right side of the president. Amazon's Jeff Bezos and Donald Trump did tangle before the election. The Washington Post took some strong positions against Donald Trump during the election.
Which
Donald
Bezos owns, right?
That's right. And Donald Trump threatened Amazon and Bezos. So I think a lot of people are understanding that even if you think you're right, you may just not have the energy for this fight. It may not be good for your business. So, there may have been that role. It's worth noting that when you look at Amazon jobs, Amazon is at the front of a movement to online shopping, which ultimately has the effect of reducing jobs overall. So as Amazon gets bigger, shops disappear. So that's a side note.
It's interesting, though, that the two companies that we just talked about are connected to media organizations that Trump
Correct.
Has problems with.
Right. So it's not necessarily that Trump doesn't like mergers and acquisitions. He has a big issue with media companies.
Okay. One more big story involving Donald Trump and a company today. He tweeted a thank you today to Linda Bean of L.L. Bean and urged people to buy L.L. Bean
yeah.
after the AP reported this week that Bean had contributed $60,000 to a pro-Trump PAC that led to a boycott of L.L. Bean. Tell us about this one.
Yeah, so this is, these things happen. A lot of CEOs donate money sometimes to candidates from both parties. But in this case, Linda Bean donated an amount of money that may have exceeded the amount that she was allowed to donate. There's still some fuzziness about that. She said she thought it was a super PAC and they could give this much, but they could only give this much. So we're working that all out. But in the process, a number of people started this boycott. And she went on Fox News this morning, and it seems that Donald Trump was watching that, because at that point he tweeted, go out and buy L.L. Bean, good on you for doing that. So that's the problem, that the president is seen to now be promoting a business that is owned in part by somebody who supported him in an election. Now, presidents typically unveil things at factories or at businesses where they know they have support, so that's not really the weird part. Again, this is much more emblematic of the kind of thing Donald Trump does. He finds a small issue and gloms onto it, so a number of people are thinking that's a little strange, particularly coming a day after he announced that he's trying to not be involved in conflicts of interest while he's president.
And between L.L. Bean and New Balance, shoes and boots have gotten very political this year. Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Donald Trump's nominees for Secretary of Defense and Director of the Central Intelligence Agency are taking questions from senators today at their confirmation hearings. If confirmed, retired U.S. Marine Corps General James Mattis and Congressman Mike Pompeo will inherit their posts during a time of turmoil, with the president-elect openly questioning the findings and assertions of U.S. intelligence agencies and promising to upend U.S. foreign policy from China to the Middle East. We're joined now by someone who held both jobs during the Obama administration. He was director of the CIA from 2009 to 2011 and secretary of defense from 2011 to 2013. He's now chairman of the Panetta Institute for Public Policy at California State University. Secretary Leon Panetta, welcome to Here and Now.
Nice to be with you.
Well, first off, what are your thoughts on Mike Pompeo, the Republican congressman who Trump has nominated to be director of the CIA?
Well, I had some dealings with him when he was on the Intelligence Committee, and he's very serious-minded and understands, I think, the intelligence arena in terms of its capabilities. He's obviously conservative politically, but I also... at least in my experience, believe that he really does want to do the right job when it comes to the CIA and our intelligence capabilities.
And what are your thoughts on General James Mattis, who is Trump's nominee for Secretary of Defense?
Well, I like Jim Mattis. He worked for me when I was Secretary of Defense. He was head of the Joint Command out in the Middle East, and was somebody who always spoke directly. He's got some clear views as a Marine, but I always felt that he was direct, he was honest, and he always gave me his best advice when it came to accomplishing the mission. So I think he brings some very good qualities to that position.
Now, by law, the Secretary of Defense is supposed to be a civilian, and General Mattis will need lawmakers to waive a 7-year waiting period between military service and appointment to the cabinet position. Do you think he should get that waiver, or do you have any problem with a general being in charge of the Defense Department?
Well, you know, I believe in civilian leadership. I think it's an important principle. It goes back to George Washington, who gave up his commission in order to become president of the United States. But I also believe that having military experience, you know, should not be a disqualifier from being Secretary of Defense. I think the key here is to have Congress make sure that Jim Mattis understands the civilian role that's involved with Secretary of Defense, because it isn't just the military side of it that is involved here. You've got to be able to relate to the president, to the American people, to the Congress, and you have to have a good sense of where the American people are when it comes to the policies that you're going to recommend to the president. So I would hope that the Congress would probe that with Jim Mattis, but I believe that he understands the importance of that role as secretary.
You gave a speech at the Democratic National Convention in July denouncing Donald Trump, calling him irresponsible and saying we cannot afford an erratic finger on our nuclear weapons. What are your concerns now that Trump has been elected about his incoming administration and national security?
Well, it's my hope that, you know, that he will be smart enough as a president of the United States to listen to the people that understand these issues. He does have a very good person in Jim Mattis, as Secretary of Defense. I like John Kelly, who's another individual that worked with me at the Department of Defense as well. And, you know, the Secretary of State, at least in the hearings yesterday, seems to be somebody who also will take a responsible approach to his duty. So if the President of the United States is willing to listen to those individuals around him who understand the importance not only of relations abroad, but how the United States must provide strong leadership, particularly when it comes to issues like nuclear proliferation, then I think we'll be in a better place. But if he tries to just shotgun these issues, that's when it becomes dangerous.
Well, what would your advice be to him on the issue of Russia, which even yesterday at his press conference, he finally conceded that he does think it was Russia that hacked the Democratic National Committee leading up to the election?
Well, I was pleased that he acknowledged Russia's role in hacking and trying to interfere with our election process. That was the conclusion of 17 intelligence agencies. So I'm glad he finally came to that conclusion. I think it's important to understand. I think his nominee for Secretary of State made the point yesterday that that Russia is an adversary. We have very different values. And Russia is going to try to continue to destabilize the United States. It may be that they were trying to help Donald Trump in this last election, but they would not hesitate to try to do everything possible to destabilize this country, even if it meant going after him when he is president. So I think he's got to be smart enough to understand that Russia is an adversary, that we do not share the same values, and that the only way to deal with the Russians, the only way to deal with Putin, is through strength and through drawing some very clear lines about what the United States stands for and what we are going to continue to fight for as a democracy.
How seriously do you take that dossier, that unverified dossier that has been out in the news in the last couple of days, and what it says about Trump's relationship with Russia?
Well, it has not been verified, and I think it really is not fair to kind of speculate as to whether or not it's true or not. I think what we do need to understand, and I think what the president-elect needs to understand, is that he has got to deal from strength with Russia. And, you know, it doesn't mean that you don't try to negotiate with the Russians. Doesn't mean that you don't try to talk with Mr. Putin, but you have to do it on the basis that our values and what the United States stands for comes first, and that we cannot compromise on those values in dealing with Russia or dealing with any other adversary.
At his press conference yesterday, Trump called that report phony and suggested it might have been released by U.S. intelligence agencies. Let's listen to a little bit of what he said.
I think it was disgraceful. That the intelligence agencies allowed any information that turned out to be so false and fake out. I think it's a disgrace. And I say that. And that's something that Nazi Germany would have done and did do.
What do you make of this back and forth between Trump and the intelligence agencies? And what do the intelligence agencies need to do to have a good relationship with the president?
Well, I'm very worried about that. I think that this bickering that's gone on for weeks between the president-elect and the intelligence community is just not—it's not good for the country, and it's not good for our national security. I mean, the president's first job as president of the United States is to protect this country, and a president can't protect this country without good intelligence about what our adversaries are up to. There should be a relationship of trust between the president and his intelligence agencies. That's essential to the ability of the president to do the job. So this kind of these kinds of comments that the president make, the kind of bickering that's been going on, I think is very dangerous because, number one, it sends a message to our adversaries, to our enemies, that somehow they might be able to take advantage of us because we are so in conflict in terms of the president and the intelligence community. Secondly, it really does impact on the credibility of the intelligence that is provided to the president. Questions raised about that in the public certainly don't help the United States. And lastly, it impacts on the morale of those that serve in the intelligence community. These are people who are really dedicated, put their lives on the line, and I think you know, what's going on now undermines their morale and their ability to do their job. All of that is dangerous in terms of the future.
And what about the issue of China? The president-elect had that conversation with the president of Taiwan shortly after he was elected. Some people are saying this is great. He's pushing back against China. But what are your thoughts, or are you worried about the relationship with China?
Well, you know, we're dealing with a president who's kind of one in a kind. You know, I've been in public life for 50 years, and every president that I've worked with, and been nine presidents, all had a great deal of experience, and both in the political world as well as foreign policy experience, and kind of understood the world that we're in. We're dealing with someone that doesn't have any of that experience. Now, he is somebody who comes out of the business world. He has certain attitudes that he has with regards to how you try to get things done. I think he's going to go through a stiff learning curve to understand that sometimes you can't just tweet your way to foreign policy for the United States. You're going to have to deal with the intricacies of foreign policy, which means take the time to understand, you know, what are the issues in dealing with China? What are the areas where we can agree with them, and what are the areas that we have to disagree with them on? But it is important for the president not simply to try to tweet his views out there, which I think, you know, just can really undermine the ability of the United States to deal with those countries like China, like Russia, and others that we have to confront. I think it would be far better for the President of the United States to take the time, understand these issues, talk to the people that understand the policies related to these countries, and then make your decisions as to what you do or do not do.
That's Leon Panetta, former director of the CIA, former secretary of defense, and now chairman of the Panetta Institute for Public Policy at California State University. Secretary Panetta, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Winter on the Great Lakes means that a seasonal pastime is underway, one that brings an economic bump to what's known as Steelhead Alley. That's a big clue. Elizabeth Miller from Great Lakes Today has more.
It's 6 a.m. when trucks and SUVs begin pulling into a parking lot in Girard, a small town on the shores of Lake Erie. They bear license plates from Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Delaware, and they've all come for one thing, steelhead trout. As they get ready to wade through the waters of Elk Creek, Patrick Robinson of Steelhead Alley Outfitters plans the day's strategy.
If we go around this corner to the right,
Steelhead Alley is a strip of rivers and tributaries along the southern shore of Lake Erie. It spans Ohio, Pennsylvania, and New York. Each state stocks steelhead in 14 creeks and rivers to promote recreational fishing. The non-native fish spends the summer in the lake before traveling back to cooler waters in the fall to spawn.
When you think about that fish and how far they travel to get there, and you get the opportunity to catch that fish, it's really a special thing.
Robinson, part-time fishing guide and full-time preacher, started leading trips in 2007. He says most customers are from out of town. He lives in Ohio. Tim O'Neill is on board for the three-day excursion.
Where I live in Delaware, we're very fortunate. We can fish 12 months out of the year, and we do fish 12 months out of the year. The one fish that we don't have are steelhead. We have to drive to find steelhead.
O'Neill's group includes a couple of friends from Dayton, Ohio, and a father and son celebrating a birthday. O'Neill, who's in the fly fishing business himself, is beside himself.
And it's just cool to catch really big, strong, angry fish in a little waterway like this.
Robinson says his business hosts a couple of hundred groups during the late fall and winter. The season is unpredictable. It usually starts in October, but it could end any time from December to April, depending when the rivers freeze up. Robinson says the Great Lakes region is such a good place to fish steelhead that he can guarantee his clients a catch, even compared to the places where steelhead is native.
You know, you go to the Pacific Northwest, and if you catch a few fish, like three fish in a week, it's been a phenomenal trip. Guys up here get kind of spoiled. You know, they'll catch three or four or five fish in a day.
Now, most of the research looking at the economic impact of Steelhead Alley is at least 10 years old. And it's based on survey responses from anglers, asking how much time they spend and how far they traveled. But that research presents staggering numbers. By stocking steelhead, millions of dollars are coming back to Pennsylvania, Ohio, and New York State. And the benefits are spilling far beyond Steelhead Alley. Park Burson is a regional manager for the outdoor retailer Orvis.
Outside of just us, it impacts, you know, the hotel and restaurant industry and you know, everything from that to gas stations along the river and lunch shops.
It's a welcome boost for the small towns like Girard, where gas stations and restaurants prepare to serve a few extra customers, who Patrick Robinson says are all aiming to land a steelhead.
Once you've hooked a fish, doesn't mean you're necessarily going to land it because they're so strong. So when you hook that, it's literally like, man, it's hard to even describe. It's just the raw power that you have on the end of your line. It just, that's the moment everybody waits for.
I got a fish.
That's the first one of the day.
For Here and Now, I'm Elizabeth Miller.
It is time now for the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
And there goes the last DJ.
Garth Trinidad is a DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, California, and joins us now. Hi, Garth.
Hey, how are you, Jimmy?
Doing well, and thanks for joining us. And let's get to some of the music that you brought us today. This is the LA singer CD Bay. This is called Every Day.
Sadness, it don't mean a thing. Cause you and me, boy, and now we're in the swing. Summer night, in the evening light, the sweet evening light. All these things we do make our dreams come true. You want me, I want you. I surely need you, baby.
What a great voice.
Oh, yeah.
Well, tell us about CD Bay.
Well, dear friend, artist, producer, DJ King Britt introduced me to her fairly recently. I think it was 2015 or 2016 via email. And he said, you know, Garth, this is someone you need to be aware of. And I hadn't heard of her before, actually. And I was actually very surprised because once I checked out, you know, her work and the caliber artist she is, I kind of slapped myself on the wrist, like, shame on you. You should know about this person. And she's currently based in Los Angeles. So I immediately took to her and invited her to come hang out at the station. And she's a big fan, big listener to KCRW. And this song in particular, she just finished recording it. I think she did a promotional video for it where she's just sort of capturing the footage of her in the studio singing the song. It's a Jamiroquai cover from one of his albums. Actually, the Traveling Without Moving album, which is just a great record of his, and certainly one of my favorite songs off that album. So when I saw that she recorded it, I think I sent her a note on like Instagram, like, hey, I have to have this. So she sent it to me and said I could share it today.
All right, well, the next one you brought us comes from across the pond, London. This is Simian Mobile Disco with Staring at All This Handle. Very different than the first one. Very energetic there, but also kind of dark.
Definitely. It's dark and straightforward, and it's very film score, actually. It reminds me of, you know, falling down the rabbit hole. I think that the sort of chords and the percussive sort of staccato thing they have going on in there, and the flanger effect, which is really, I think, what that is in essence, the way it sort of twists and turns and fades and comes back with the beat and the bass line. And that tension there, it just kind of reminds me of something that you would hear accompanying a great sort of chase sequence or something, you know, to that sort of dramatic effect in a film.
When you say the flanger effect, by the way, what does that mean?
It's what's another way to describe it? It's when you're listening to the melody and the sort of staccato percussion, and it's kind of coming in and out, like it doesn't stay in the same place. It sort of meanders in its tone. That's the flanger. It's kind of squishes down and comes back up and then gets a little quiet or moves to the left, you know. That's the effect they have going on there.
Well, what else should we know about Simian Mobile Disco?
Well, I like their sound because it's electronic dance music, but not EDM, right? The EDM thing is a whole other animal. It really is kind of deep house and house music in its most core essence. These guys, it's James Ford and Jazz Shaw. Actually, Jazz is also James, but he sort of uses jazz to separate himself from the other James. They were in a couple of different bands together. One was like an electronic rock band. One was like a drum and bass hip hop band. So they're sort of well versed musicians, and they have this kind of cool raw analog sound to their version of electronic dance music. And their music is evolving, and it's gritty, and it's soulful, but it's house music. And that's to me, it's a great sort of illustration of how far you can take house music, because house music has never truly been co-opted to be like a commercial commodity. So it's been allowed to experiment and sort of take all these different forms without being painted inside of any lines or box.
All right. Well, up next, we've got the artist Sam Von Horn. This is called Zone.
I've been waiting for, waiting. I've been waiting for, I've been waiting.
Very interesting sound there. I like what's going on in the background as well.
Yeah, definitely. This is Sam's debut EP. Sam has been making music for a long time, but kind of, you know, as a bedroom artist, you know, not really ready to bring things out. So this is like his stepping out moment. And this song I chose is the title track to the EP. It's the only one where Sam actually performs a vocal. Everything else is like, you know, a lot of samples and loops and really kind of sweet instrumental pieces. But this is like a song, like the one song that's featured on the EP.
And you found this how?
You know what? I think either a friend or the label sent it to me. I get, you know, the inbox is just bombarded with all kinds of stuff. And, you know, I'd have to trace it back to know exactly where. But, you know, it came via email.
You know, in my email inbox, it's just pitches from public relations specialists. Unfortunately, I don't get all these songs to come in. But anyway, let's get to the last one here. This is from Jim James, who is the front man of the band My Morning Jacket. This is a solo song, though. This is called True Nature. Sultry sound there, and it sounds like there's some Motown and funk influences.
Definitely. I think one of the reasons why I appreciate Jim James for, you know, a lot of his contributions, and I have to be, you know, honest in all candor, I wasn't really, though very aware of My Morning Jacket, I never really got into paying attention to the music until Jim's first solo project. And then, of course, some of the other stuff he was doing with the Bob Dylan sort of homage, the New Basement tapes, and then the Monsters of Folk with Connor and Mike from Bright Eyes, and then the M Ward stuff. I really began to notice like what he was doing, and that first solo record and now the Eternally Even, I'm really turned on by his sound. And he's got all these jazz nods and blues nods and Motown nods, and you just hear it. And I think if there's a theme for me through the bottom line, the baseline of how I program, has got to be sultry. I think you kind of nailed it on the head. And I think my wife was the first person to really point this out to me. And this is years ago. She said, you like sultry music. You like sultry sounds. And I'm like, Yeah, I do.
So, and why do you think that is?
I don't know. I'm a Pisces, and I'm very emotional and sensitive, and I kind of like that dynamic, sultry thing in music. I don't know what it is, but it's there, and that's part of my true nature.
All right, well, thanks for bringing us some of those sultry sounds. Garth Trinidad, DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica. Great to have you.
Man, my pleasure, Jeremy. Thank you.
And you can hear all our DJ session picks on our Spotify playlist. Just go to Spotify, search for NPR Here and Now. You can also find us on Apple Music or at hereandnow.org.
Today, officials in Baltimore announced the terms of a federal consent decree to improve policing. Nearly 2 years after Freddie Gray died in the back of a police van, sparking protests, riots, and questions about racial bias. This past summer, the Obama Justice Department ordered the reforms in Baltimore, as it has in 14 other police departments, finding that Baltimore police unlawfully stopped and arrested large numbers of people in African-American neighborhoods and often used unnecessary force against them. Baltimore Mayor Catherine Pugh said the agreement is a good start.
We hire our police department to protect and serve our citizens. We know that many of them put their lives on the line, but it's important that every aspect, every individual, every person, regardless of what you think about them, what you thought they might have been doing, everybody deserves respect.
Kenneth Burns is with WYPR in Baltimore. Hi, Kenny.
Hi, Robin.
So list some of the things this agreement requires the city to do.
Well, this will require officers to use de-escalation tactics when necessary. They'll require more training of officers, require standards for transporting the people they arrest. And there is a whole section on how to treat sexual assault victims. There has been a reported history in regards to how seriously, or more accurately, how unseriously, some investigators take some of the sexual assault cases.
It also addressing the mentally ill on the streets. Well, what are police saying about these reforms and the fact that the city has to hire a police monitor?
Well, it should be noted that the FOP...
And this is the Fraternal Order of Police. These are the police.
This is the Fraternal Order of Police. Their president, Gene Ryan, put out a statement not too long ago, despite continued assurances by representatives of the Department of Justice that our organization would be included in the consent decree negotiations, no request to participate was ever forthcoming, and we were not involved in the process.
Well, so the Fraternal Order of Police, the organization that represents police, may be feeling outside the process, but we understand your police chief is applauding it.
He is applauding it. He was at the news conference today. He called it a path forward for reforms that they began before the civil rights investigation took place.
Now, the Obama Justice Department has pursued civil rights investigations in 25 law enforcement agencies. These resulted in consent decrees in Cleveland, Albuquerque, New Orleans, Seattle. In his confirmation hearing this week, Attorney General nominee Jeff Sessions was asked about these kinds of civil rights consent agreements and lawsuits about police use of force. Here's some of what he said.
I think there's concern that good police officers and good departments can be sued by the Department of Justice mm-hmm. when you just have individuals within a department who have done wrong. And these lawsuits undermine the respect for police officers and create an impression that the entire department is not in doing their work consistent with fidelity to law and fairness, and we need to be careful before we do that.
So, Kenny, couple questions. There where you are in Baltimore, are people concerned that a whole department is being painted with the brush that maybe should be applied to just individuals, and that there may be a backlash from that, as some people say they've seen in other cities, police maybe stepping back from enforcement of the law because they feel in jeopardy of liability?
Well, that's hard to say. That was the feeling shortly after the six officers that were charged in Freddie Gray's death. There was that sentiment among the officers. But now, almost 2 years later, we're dealing with different issues. The police union is making hay out of not enough officers on the force to patrol the city. That's number one. And then among the citizens, when the report came out last summer, there was not really a shock as far as what the Justice Department found. It was something that they always believed, they always thought was taking place. And for them, this was really just a confirmation.
Look, we are having a new attorney general come in. Is there a sense in Baltimore that this call for reform and implementing reform got in under the wire?
In a way, it did. In fact, Attorney General Loretta Lynch had addressed what becomes of the agreement. Will there be a possibility that the Justice Department will roll it back? Well, she said, no, this agreement is now a court document. So once the federal judge signs off on it, it's binding. And there's no stepping back from it at that point.
Yeah. And by the way, you mentioned Freddie Gray's death again. The six police officers charged, none were convicted. Your city now, new mayor, new police chief. Is there a sense of moving forward?
There is a sense of moving forward, particularly with the mayor. There is a sense, at least among officials, to move forward and work together and address the systemic issues of crime in Baltimore, not just the issues that everyone knows about in terms of the civil rights violations.
Kenny Burns of WIPR in Baltimore, thank you.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.